Welcome to the Farmers Weekly Podcast. This episode recorded on Friday, the 26th of August, 2022. From the Farmers Weekly News Desk, I'm Johan Tasker.
And I'm Hugh Broom.
In this episode, how a new buying group started by a Darlington livestock farmer could help your business beat farm input inflation.
On the markets, as harvest draws to a close, we look at some of the latest yield data.
We meet the Welsh farmer's wife who was lucky to escape with her life after being attacked by a freshly calved cow.
And we find out how Norfolk farmers are joining forces to benefit wildlife and the environment.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
But first, further uncertainty in the fertiliser market this week. CF Fertilisers announced that they will stop ammonia production at their Billingham plant because of a further rise in gas costs. The move is also expected to affect CO2 supplies across the UK. The US manufacturer are instead going to import liquid ammonia required for fertiliser manufacturing. The company expects to fulfil all of its orders for products in the coming months. Now, Cumbrian MP and EFRA committee member Neil Hudson told me that this latest development was a big blow.
When the situation changed with INTS and they CF Fertilisers indicated they wanted to move away from production at that plant, then we were then left in the UK with just one plant in terms of fertiliser and CO2. And now we've had the announcement this week that they are planning to halt ammonia production. And that has significant consequences, you know, for our resilience in this country, for food security, for farming resilience. And I, as a vet, am very, very worried as well about what this means for animal welfare, because as we know, CO2 is vital for the food and drink sector, but it's vital for some of the humane slaughter processes in abattoirs for pigs and poultry.
He said he was calling on the government to intervene.
It does seem need some major intervention. And I've today written to the Secretary of State for DEFRA. I've tabled parliamentary questions and I've brought this to our EFRA Select Committee again. And as a result, our committee is, as we speak, we are writing to the Secretary of State and also to the business secretary as well. This has a real implication for national resilience. So we're urging the government to, you know, to get round the table, talk to CF Fertiliser and see what can be done to mitigate any possible negative outcomes from this.
Nick Allen is from the British Meat Processors Association.
The first we knew about it was Wednesday afternoon. I got a phone call from the press sort of saying that they'd announced that they were going to close the plant and cease production there. They haven't yet. Everyone at the moment is racing around taking stock of where are we? So how much we've got in stock? You know, what does this mean? We are in a lot better place than we were a year ago. A year ago, everyone was talking about CF Industries supplying about sort of 60% of the CO2 that we needed. Now it's about 30%. You know, other supplies have come on stream and we're slightly less sort of vulnerable to it. But it is concerning because it means yet again we're going to be more dependent on imports going forward.
He told me that the supply base for CO2 should become more diverse.
I think it's a question of encouraging other sectors to capture the CO2 that they're venting. One of the things that came out last time, a lot of people, and someone's already been in touch with me today, sort of saying, well, actually, so we do produce CO2 and we just vent it. So actually, I think government should be looking at it, encouraging and perhaps grants to capture this, you know, to encourage people to capture the CO2 so we can capture it from our other sort of processing sort of sections. So we're not just dependent on one plant. And I think that's probably the way forward rather than just relying on coming out of fertilizer plants because it is the absolute cheapest. And of course, you know, now that it's gone up in value a bit, you know, there's a bit more encouragement to do that all round.
This week, it was also announced that other European fertilizer manufacturers are shutting down because of the latest rise in gas prices. NFU Deputy President Tom Bradshaw told me the developments are very worrying.
We've always been seriously concerned about what was going to happen this winter once we got into winter gas prices with Europe trying to wean itself off Russian gas. There was huge concerns. And the news this week about Billingham stopping ammonia production and importing liquid ammonia to the plant and fulfilling current orders, but suggesting they won't be taking any more orders from the press release. It's hugely worrying about the availability of nitrogen fertilizer. And you know, we have to think that even when we were producing fertilizer here, we were only 40 to 50% self-sufficient. So we were reliant on imports. a lot of that came in from Poland and with Poulan and products like that, and it's simply not going to be available to get from those areas of Europe now.
He went on to say that the government really needed to take the issue of fertilizer supply very seriously.
I think it is the time for government to recognize the importance of fertilizer to our domestic food security, but also the role globally for nitrogen fertilizer in underpinning global food production. And what happens if that's not available? I mean, we're talking about famine in some parts of the world. We're talking about mass migration from places where they can't afford the food or aren't producing it. And I think these are incredibly worrying times for both the country with the cost of living crisis here, but also what's going to be happening globally.
Joe Gilbertson from the Agricultural Industries Confederation, the AIC, told me that the current gas price makes fertilizer manufacturing very expensive.
The price of gas at the moment and the forward price going towards Christmas suggests a sort of theoretical cost of production of somewhere around about £1,500 a ton for fertilizer, which, puts it in a place where nobody can really countenance producing it for that because they wouldn't expect sales. That's hypothetical because nobody's actually putting product on the market at that price, but that's an indication to your listener that that's what the current cost of gas means in terms of production of material. Obviously, if you go to a country where the gas price is not affected by the Ukrainian-Russian conflict, for example, the States, the price of gas is measured in pennies still.
He told me that the recent energy price hike has caught everyone in the industry out.
We were thinking that this stage would be reached in about 20 years' time. We didn't realise, perhaps as an industry, that fuel feedstock prices would get to this level so quickly. And therefore, the whole of the energy input industry is not really prepared for this. We're still gas dependent. Unless we can come up with a very quick and cheap means of producing masses of hydrogen, we're stuck with having to burn gas. So then the question is, does government intervene to reduce the gas price, or do they leave us?
That's Joe Gilbertson from the AIC.
So they're not actually stopping production at Billingham, Hugh, but what's actually happening here?
So what CF Fertilisers have said is that they're going to ship in ammonia liquid from probably America, where they've got plants and gas is really cheap compared to the European price, bring that into the UK and use that ammonia to make the ammonium nitrate fertiliser. Normally, they would use natural gas. They would take natural gas, blast steam across it, liberate the hydrogen from the methane, the natural gas is methane, and then use the hydrogen with the Haber-Bosch process to make the ammonium. But obviously, because the gas price being so high, they've stopped doing that. Some people may be saying, hey, why can't you take the hydrogen from water? Well, they used to do that. I don't know if they still do, but they certainly used to do it. The old Norsk hydro fertilizer we used to see around from Scandinavia, where they got bags of hydroelectric power. But one of the downsides of that is it takes about 6 to 7 times more energy to liberate the hydrogen molecules using electrolysis from water than it does if you do it the sort of the way with steam and methane. Although some would argue at the moment, given the price of gas at the moment, it might be cheaper to do that. But then, of course, electricity is worth a lot of money as well. So you're snookered either way. So as you heard in the audio there from Joe Gilbertson, this is all about a hydrogen source and trying to find a hydrogen source that doesn't rely on gas or electrolysis is a bit of a tricky conundrum at the moment.
And the impact on CO2 production, there's obviously a big knock-on effect there too.
We've been here before with the CO2. Look, a year ago, wasn't it, we had the same problems developing. I suppose the difference now is that the estimation is that only 30% of the UK's CO2 requirement is coming from CF Fertilizers factory, whereas a year ago, it was 60%. And also, interestingly, in the audio, you heard Nick say there was, other industries phoning him to say, hey, we've got CO2, how do we get it to you? Well, it's a tricky and expensive thing to do anything with gases, but you've got to clean them. You've got to purify them, liquefy them, put them in cylinders. none of it is cheap. So there's not, whilst there will be industries out there that produce, I don't know, brewing, for example, will produce CO2 as a small byproduct, clearly they've got to have it in some quantity to justify the investment. So whilst it's good that there's some diversity in the market, it's not an instant quick fix. And of course, the other thing that's going to impact on this CO2 supply issue is the other fertilizers that in the last week or so have announced factories elsewhere in Europe that are shutting down completely their production because of the gas price, and they would be other potential sources of CO2. And unfortunately, they won't be there either.
And the longer term implications of this, I mean, this has happened again. We need a solution, don't we?
Of course we need a solution. But, you know, the world energy crisis or the Western European energy crisis that we're seeing at the moment needs a solution. And this ties back into it. It's not an easy solution, however you look at it. I think, if you look at it just at the CF thing, some optimists, and I said this to Joe Gilbertson actually, I said, well, optimistically, at least we're still producing fertilizer. And if they choose to continue to produce fertilizer and doing so by bringing in this ammonia from the US, where gas is a lot cheaper, then that's a good thing, bearing in mind that lots of European factories have shut down because of the gas price and where they've only got that gas option as their raw material. I suppose the big question mark is, now Joe said to me, when he spoke to CF, they were all carrying on business as normal, no plans to change anything major, which let's hope that is the case. Some people, though, are drawing attention to the fact in the press release it says we will commit to fulfill the contracts we have, but then there was no definitive statement that said, and then we carry on, you know, producing. So who knows? There's a question mark there. The other irony as well, which is, I suppose, part of a grand plan, is there's been loads of headlines about sewage pollution in rivers and seas and how the water companies have failed to treat wastewater properly. And you just think about the sheer tonnage. It's colossal, isn't it? I know some sewage sludge goes to land, but the vast majority of it is ending up going back out into waterways and back out to sea. And we're totally missing a trick there as a society into capturing all of that nutrient and utilizing it. It will, and there's no quick fix to that. That is going to take billions and billions of investment to get it up to speed to be able to do that. In the short term, I suppose, the big worry yet again, though, is long-term yield impacts. Again, talking to Joe Gilbertson after the interview, he said, you know, sales of compound fertilizer products, particularly those aimed at grassland farmers, have been pretty woeful this year, not surprisingly because of the cost, which then leaves another big question mark over what forage stocks look like. And long term, if fertilizer prices stay high, not just here, but elsewhere across the world, as we've said before, long term, it's not good news for yields. It's not good news for production. And that's just generally not good news for consumers and the global market, is it? If there is a constriction and constraint of supply.
Have you started thinking about next year's harvest yet? Now could be the right time. If you want the best return on investment and the best quality output, you need to act fast to secure this very special offer from Massey Ferguson. Designed solely with your business in mind, choose from our large range of grass equipment, including rakes, mowers and tedders, small, round and large square balers, and our game-changing lineup of conventional straw walker and hybrid separation combine harvesters. The faster you move, the better the offer. With up to 10% off on 2023 delivered machines and equipment, with 0% finance available. Speak to your local MF dealer today or visit masseyferguson.co.uk for more details.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
A Welsh farmer's wife who also works as a nurse suffered a fractured eye socket after being attacked by a freshly calved cow. Corinne Matthias told her story to Richard Stanton as part of our Farmers Weekly Dying to Feed You farm safety campaign.
Started as a normal Saturday. I was at home because we don't tend to work weekends. Most of the work had been done in the morning. We had a bit of lunch and Robert and Geraint decided there was a local football match. They'd go and watch it, seeing as the work was up to date. So off they went. Rebecca wasn't at home because she was in uni. It was a lovely day, a nice, dry, sunny day for April the 1st. So I decided I'd take the dogs out for a walk in the afternoon. So we set off and just went up by the shed and just had a look in because it was open-fronted shed. And I could see that there was a cow just sort of on about to calve. So the cow calved and I just waited a second and looked. The calf wasn't moving or making any attempt to move. So without thinking, I just went in and he started then just moving and took a breath. And so I thought, oh, he's okay now. And then whilst I was seeing to the calf, I was watching the cow that had just calved because sometimes they can be a bit wary of people and protective over the newborn calf. Didn't really think anything of the cows that were, the other cows that were in the loose shed. But as I got up, another cow hit me in the face with her head. She sort of sent me flying. And as I kept trying to get up, she just kept hitting me back down again. She sent me backwards across the shed till I was against the wall. So when she was hitting my head, the back of my head was hitting the concrete block wall behind me. I was trying to get from there, but I backed myself into a corner. Possibility was I was knocked out for a few seconds, maybe, because I don't really remember all of it. And I remember thinking, I must get out from here because people get killed with cattle like this. Then something took her attention and she turned round and I just saw my chance to get out from there and got out through the feed barrier at the front of the shed. I just crawled up. There was a bit of grass slope, so I just crawled up on there and sat down for a minute. I just sort of sat there thinking what was hurting most, because I could feel my face was stinging and my leg was stinging, my nose was bleeding. Robert and Geraint hadn't arrived home just then, so I had still got my phone in my pocket. So I phoned them and said, you'd better come, because I said the cows had me.
Corinne says she was so badly bruised that medical staff didn't recognise her when she arrived at the hospital where she works after the accident.
It was quite busy. It was a Saturday afternoon. But eventually we got x-ray. They x-rayed my face and my leg. The leg was okay, although it was getting more swollen and there was a big blister appearing on it. And the face showed that I'd fractured my eye socket. The funny thing is, it wasn't that painful. It was more stinging from the, because it was like cut around the eye as well. So that was more painful than the actual fracture, really. But obviously I learnt eventually that the fracture could have led to the eye dropping and having to need an operation to put a little plate to keep the eyeball up. It was uncomfortable and I couldn't see. Yeah, I was off work 6 weeks. And then only went back on like a phased return. You always think it's not going to happen to you. If I hadn't have rushed in that day without thinking, if I'd have just stopped and gave it a couple of minutes, I could have probably saved myself from that accident. Apple. Oh, yeah, definitely. I do think I was lucky. Out of being unlucky, I think I did have a lucky escape. I'm still here, so...
That's Welsh farmer's wife, Corinne Matthews.
So, yeah, and Corinne was really lucky here, wasn't she? She managed to, the cow basically stopped having a go, something caught its eye, and she managed to escape.
Yeah, very, very lucky indeed. I mean, imagine here, you going to a hospital where you work, and the staff there don't even recognise you. Your work colleagues don't recognise you because you're so badly injured. It must have been absolutely horrific. This is part of our Dying to Feed You campaign, farm safety campaign that we've been running for the last 12 months in partnership with Safety Revolution. And yeah, as you say, Corinne is very, very lucky indeed.
So Johan, this just comes back to them. As she says in the interview and in the piece that you had there, the piece in the magazine this week, you know, it is about thinking twice before you go in to a situation like this with animals, making sure you've got the right penning, making sure you've got the right protection, or better still, if there's another person there, that someone there to watch your back. This year, farm fatalities, thankfully, have actually gone down. They've gone down quite a bit, haven't they?
They have gone down. They're about half of what they were last year. I have to say, though, Hugh, the pattern remains the same. It's the same sort of injuries and deaths involving cattle, fatalities involving cattle. There were two of them last year. So it's still an issue.
Yeah, it is still an issue. I mean, we had a really tragic story down here in the southeast this week. A lady in Sussex walking a dog across a field was killed by a group of cattle. So it's still going on. When you look at the numbers, yeah, it's good news that they are back quite considerably. But like you say, still a lot of the trends remain the same. 36% of fatalities are workers that are over 65. 56% are self-employed. The really scary one for me is this members of the public figure, that the average, what is it, over a five-year period, 23 people and members of the public have been killed, a third of those were children. So yeah, it is quite scary. So the numbers are still pretty high, and I think you're still the highest probability of any job of being fatally injured, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. It's one of the most dangerous occupations in the country for various reasons, and lone working is one of them. Don't go into a pen without notifying somebody, and avoid working in a pen with livestock alone. That's the advice in this particular instance. But I just want to say again, we've covered our Dying to Feed You campaign before, Hugh, and we're really, really grateful for the people that have spoken out, told their stories, the farm accident survivors, because I think, you know, it is a case of their, but for the grace of God go I, that we've all done stuff we shouldn't have done. It's you do things automatically sometimes, and you just for a split second your mind might not be on the job. You might go and do something without thinking it through. So thanks to Corinne for that. Her message is to do just that: assess the situation a little bit longer, take your time, and think ahead.
Here at ICL, we're constantly searching for new ways to help farmers maximise yield while reducing their impact on the environment. Extensive trials have shown that autumn application of polysulfate improves nutrient uptake, increases root mass, and reduces environmental losses from the field. To find out more, go to polysulfate.com.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
You're indeed listening to the Farmers Weekly Podcast. A very warm welcome to you wherever you happen to be listening to us from this bank holiday weekend. You will possibly, most of you, I think most people have finished harvest now, long done. So good news there. And better still, in the south of the UK, right up through, Johan, some rain. Did you have a lot of rain in Suffolk on Thursday?
We did indeed. We had an absolutely torrential downpour overnight. I don't have a rain gauge shoe, so I can't tell you exactly how much we had, but we had lightning. We didn't have much thunder, but I understand a little bit further west to us, Bishop Stortford, it was thunder like you've never heard before, and torrential rain there too. So it's lumpy, isn't it, this rain? We could do with it being a bit spread out rather than all coming in one go and then disappearing again.
Yeah, absolutely. And we had good solid rain here, actually. It was heavy, steady, but it was nice, solid, and it rained most of the day. I can tell you that it was almost a full cat bowl outside the back door of rain. That's the extent of my rain gauge. So that means there's been quite a lot. I think we had about 12. We must have had 12, 15 mil here. Some parts of North Norfolk, they had ridiculous amounts of rain, and it was quite localised as well. You know, talking to people in Essex, some people had, you know, 60 mil, and then down the road, they barely had 8. So there are still some people that are very dry, but it was certainly some welcome respite from the dryness. The moment, next week's dry, week after, on my screen at the moment for Surrey, there's a few unsettled days as well. So yeah, before we know it, we've only had too much rain. podcast@fwi.co.uk is our email address. Please do feel free to send us a message about whatever you like, really. Johan, emails this week.
Email from Tim Evans from Ashted, Hugh. He says, joined up thinking, this is in relation to, well, any number of stories that we do involving government policy when it comes to agriculture. The left hand often doesn't know or doesn't seem to know what the right hand is doing. So Tim says, joined up thinking, isn't that the Prime Minister's job to coordinate the departments and ensure government is joined up? That's really the main job the Prime Minister has to do. Great podcast. Thanks. That's from Tim Evans in Ashton.
We can indeed live in hope that perhaps the new Prime Minister, I don't know, yeah, let's just reserve judgment and see what happens. Let's hope that's the case and they get all joined up and we have a super-duper plan going forward.
Another email, Hugh, from John Kane. You've been upsetting the listeners, Hugh. He says he's a big fan of the podcast, but disappointed by your segment on Jane Buxton. This was the review of the book, The Great Plant-Based Con. John says that you argue that being a journalist from outside the industry is somehow an advantage. Is it? It sounds just like George Monbiot to me. John says that he thinks we have an agenda when reviewing this book. He says Jane literally started the interview by saying she started researching her book because she doesn't like vegan diets. It doesn't sound unbiased to him.
Yeah, it's a fair cop, John. You're right. It's not some perfectly balanced scientific view. As you quite rightly say, she starts from the premise that she didn't like the sound of vegan or plant-only diets when it came to sort of dietary need, I suppose. It just didn't bode well with her, hence why she started writing the book. I suppose my point wasn't that she was some totally independent scientist. It was more the fact that she was coming at it from the average, I suppose, as average a consumer that a journalist and author happens to be, point of view, as opposed to a lot of these books are written by people who are, you know, very entrenched on keeping cows or very entrenched on not keeping cows, and there's not much middle ground. That was my point. But yes, you're absolutely right. It's not some perfectly balanced scientific journal type appraisal. I do apologise. Moving on. What's in the magazine this week?
140 pages of Farmers Weekly goodness this week, Hugh. We'll start with the livestock section. We've got a marketing special with a focus on Devon farmer David Rossiter, who's using estimated breeding values as his marketing strategy for pedigree stock. In the arable section, we're looking at no-till potatoes. Is the concept of no-till potatoes just a pipe dream? We're looking at what Dyson Farming is doing there. They're big potato producers, and they're, well, I guess, you know, as you probably expect from a business with strong connections owned by Jim Dyson, they're taking an innovative approach to agriculture, just as he took an innovative approach to the vacuum cleaner. So they're sort of turning the world on its head and looking at no-till potatoes and making it a success.
Is it indeed possible? We shall have to wait and see. There's a good feature about Berkshire Farm Girl, otherwise known as Eleanor Gilbert, who has a big following on Twitter, a feature about her. Many people will know of her. Also, there's a feature about Love Lamb Week, which starts 1st of September, I think, and Richard Finlay, NFU Livestock Chair, talking about challenges facing livestock producers like we didn't know. But what's really important is Richard talks about the NFU about to launch an intense survey in a week or two to try and gauge really what people's feelings are, what they're going to continue doing, what they're going to stop doing. So we'll keep an eye on that, because that'll be an interesting piece of work when finally it is published.
And in the machinery section, we've got an ultimate guide for pickups, ATVs, UTVs and commercial SUVs.
Alas, there's still no electric pickups in there, which is still really, I'll just keep nursing my beaten up Hilux a little bit longer in the hope that one day an electric truck might come along.
A quick look at what's in this week's Farmers Weekly, available from your village shop, all good news agents, and via subscription at fwi.co.uk. Hugh, the markets, what's happening?
Or indeed other shops that aren't in villages. And the finished steer deadweight goes up slightly this week, 434.5, up from 433.9 last week. The live weight, 242.2, that's back 2p on the week. Sheep prices, deadweight SQQ this week's back slightly, 542.8, back from 545 last week. The live weight price drops back as well, 239.2, back from 242. Arable markets all seem to have firmed up a little bit this week. Feed wheat, £250 dead, up from 245. Milling wheat goes up to, well, about £1.50, up to £291.50. Feed barley goes up 8 quid to £230.10. Oilseed rape gets £8 on at £508 this week. Feed peas gain £6 at £276. Feed beans gain £5 at £285. And a litre of red diesel this week will cost you £109.2. P. Now, turning our attention to the arable markets, harvest is pretty much done now, wherever you are. Still some combining to do, I think, in the north of Scotland or in Scotland. Occasional pockets of spring beans and bits and bobs, but on the whole, everything has been in for some week. Megan Hesketh joins me now from HDB. She's one of the senior arable analysts there. Megan, starting to piece together now what the yield picture looks like for the UK. Has the drought had a big impact?
So we are seeing a differentiation based on that soil type. So for winter barley especially, we saw yields varying from those lightest lands at 6 tonnes per hectare up to the 12.5 tonnes per hectare on those heavier lands. And we saw that across crop types, a differentiation based on that area, just with that heavier land retaining moisture for longer over those drives. Spells. But yeah, overall, yields are looking pretty good.
So breaking it down, let's start with oil seeds. What do they look like at the moment?
Oilseed rape was completed in week 6 of our report. So weekend in the 16th of August. And we saw the average yield coming in at 3.2 to 3.6 tonnes per hectare for oilseed rape. So pretty good yields. And we have noted limited cabbage stem flea beetle damage this time.
Turn our attention to the wheat crop. Is that done well? Has that done better than the barley overall, would you say?
In terms of the yields, we're looking at about 8.2 to 8.6 the GB average this time. So spring yields were varying from 4 to 8.5 tonnes per hectare. And like I say, similar story to what we've seen in the barley is depends on what soil type as well. So those light sandy soils were lower yielding than those heavier moisture retaining soils. But generally overall, we're looking at pretty decent yields. And considering the dry spells that we have had, overall, pretty good.
So when we start to round all this yield data up, what do UK stocks now look like going forward, Megan?
Towards the end of last season, we saw quite a few imports at the end of the season. So we did see quite a bit of carryover in store. Whether that's merchant ported co-ops or whether that's on farm as well. And when with harvest pretty early this time, we are looking at an abundant supply of feed wheat, especially in the UK. We are still seeing quite a bit of wheat hanging around and what that will mean for how we're trading at the first half of the year, especially whether we're trading close to that export parity as to when we get further through the year. But on the overall whole for globally, we're still pretty tight in terms of the demand and supply balance for wheat. And we are still seeing relatively supported levels for that wheat price.
And then when we look at talk about wheat quality, you're saying quite a bit of pickup there or availability of feed wheat, presumably because proteins in a lot of cases are back.
We've been seeing HAGBO fall in numbers and specific weights. They're all hitting specs and pretty good. There is some concerns over the protein, slightly lower than ideal. Some samples are out of spec, we're seeing. And that's often due to the nitrogen uptake was limited through those dry conditions at application. And it's those crops that we have seen suffer on those proteins.
That's HDB senior arable analyst Megan Hesketh.
Cereals 360 from KWS is back. Join our virtual showground to see crop tours across all of our key varieties of barley, hybrid rye, oilseed rape and wheat. Learn as you listen to KWS experts talking for our main crop portfolio covering yield, agronomy, end markets and disease resistance. Visit www.cereals360.co.uk to try it out for yourself.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Now, Darlington Farmer is helping his fellow livestock producers beat farm input inflation and raise money for charity at the same time. Discounts on farm inputs are possible through the Farm Buyer Club, an online buying group created by Harry Hodgson and technology businessman Nick Vaughan. Club membership is free and it uses the combined buying power of hundreds of farmers to obtain discounts in return for a small commission. Harry told us how the club works.
I just saw there was an opportunity for all farmers, large and small, to join together and club together to help each other save money by buying as one rather than as individuals.
And how does it work then? If I wanted to take advantage of this, if I wanted to use Farm Buyer Club, what do I have to do?
Some products are available through a traditional e-commerce platform. So you can go onto our site and select various items that will be picked and packed and posted straight out. The other side of it is, say, animal medicine. You would go onto our site, select what you want. But that works slightly differently in that you don't get a price in immediately. But the beauty of animal medicine is we all, as sheep farmers or cattle farmers, whatever, generally we're all working in the same season. We all want stuff roughly at the same time. So when you select what medicine you want, that will go to our medicine supplier and partner, and they will compile all of the orders so that you're getting a better price. So instead of you buying, let's say you wanted one bottle of Click, let's say, but chances are you, your neighbors, your friends, other farmers throughout the country also want Click at the same time. If they submit on our website that they want some Click, instead of you trying to buy one bottle of Click, there could be 40, 50, 80 bottles of Click being ordered that week. So suddenly our medicine supplier can offer a much better price because they're looking a much larger order.
This is similar to a traditional buying co-op then, Harry, but what do you offer that's different?
We see ourselves as different to a buying group, and there's some really good buying groups out there who are doing a great job for their members, and I'm not trying to decry that at all, but we're trying to really focus on the livestock sector where most of the small family farms lie. Not all, obviously, but that's what our aim is really to try and safeguard the small family farms, which don't always have access to these groups, or find that the buying groups have an upfront charge, which sometimes may put them off. Whereas we're trying to sort of simplify everything by there is no charge to be part of our group.
And the good thing about Farm Buyer Club is you're delivering products to farmers at a great price, but you're also raising money for farm charities at the same time.
Farming is going to come under a huge amount of pressure in the coming years with change of agricultural policy. And at the moment, we're all well aware that the suicide rate in agriculture is far too high. And I've lost far too many friends. So it's something that we're very passionate about because it's something that affects our industry very disproportionately. So that's why we've signed up with the Mint Ridge Foundation, who have an agricultural arm, and they're going into agricultural universities and colleges to educate and advise young agricultural students on mental health and how to manage it and how it isn't a taboo subject and you're better off just to talk to people and get things out in the open. And we're open to working with as many people and as many charities in that respect as possible.
That's Harry Hodgson of the Farm Buyer Club. And if you want to find out more and perhaps join yourself, simply visit farmbuyerclub.com.
So, Johan, this buying group concept, I mean, excuse me for being a bit facetious here, but isn't this what the likes of, I don't know, Anglia or Mole Valley or all Fram Farmers, there's a whole myriad of farm buying groups.
You're right, Hugh, and Harry says that himself. But I think with this idea, it's a very streamlined operation. There are no sort of backup office staff in this. I guess it's what you could call a disruptor business. You know, it's come along, it's offering something that's very simple. It's doing so at a very, very affordable rate.
Yeah, no, it's really important. I always remember when I went to a thing in Brussels years ago about producer organisations, and input buying was illustrated in one piece. It was a lady from France that was delivering a paper that she'd written, an academic paper, and there was two buying groups she outlined. Well, one was just a selling group, so all they did was sell pigs on behalf of these French pig farmers so they could sell X trillion pigs a week because they had a big book. And then the other one was selling the pigs and doing all the input buying. And the really interesting thing was, and it's probably no great surprise, that whilst the selling only group always got the highest price for the piggies, it was the profit margins of the businesses in the all-round buying group, ISA, where they were buying and selling, their profit margins were considerably higher than the other businesses because they were just buying their inputs more competitively. So they are really important, these groups, aren't they?
They are really important. I think, you know, with ag inflation going through the roof, you know, prices have increased by about a quarter for farm inputs on average over the past year. It is a case of every little helps, as one of the major supermarkets says. The other thing, Hugh, that I liked about this is that a percentage of the profits in the long term are going to be donated to the agricultural arm of the Mintridge Foundation, and that's a charity that educates young farmers about mental health. We know about the stresses and strains on farming. They are, as far as I can see, only going to become greater over the coming years as farm policy changes and as pressure on farm margins increases. So it's great to see that this is a business that really is putting something back into the farming community.
Absolutely. And look, it could be the next big massive buying group in 10 or 15 years' time. So the very best of luck to them. And thank you, all the buying groups out there doing such sterling work at trying to combat the battle that is farm input inflation. Thank you.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
And finally, farmers big and small are working together to improve wildlife and biodiversity on the North Norfolk coast. They're making a big difference by taking small but effective measures, such as changing the management of drainage ditches to provide more space for many more species, even as coastal habitats are being squeezed by sea level rises. Norfolk farmer Michael Smith, who grazes beef cattle on about 30 hectares of freshwater marshland, is part of the project.
My involvement as a small landowner has been fairly limited, but I was very keen to get in with the collaboration of the larger landowners, which have got pockets of land either side. I'm very, very aware that the unique area that I have, which is the freshwater marsh between these large landowners, it's not possible to act singly and alone in the drive for greater biodiversity. When you look at boundaries, dikes, ditches, they cross boundaries, they cross landowners, and wildlife corridors are needed across various landowners. Certainly, with the move away from high-level stewardship and basic payment schemes into ELMs, I'm fully aware that as someone with only 69 acres, the ability to employ my own specialists is very, very difficult, but actually it's just as difficult as doing major projects which cross the boundaries of where other landowners are. So, yeah, I was keen to not necessarily hop on the tails of the larger landowners, but work alongside and with them in order to make sure the best outcome across all the river, the valley and the wildlife can be achieved for everybody.
So by working together, by collaborating with your neighbours, you can have more of an impact, a beneficial impact on biodiversity, but also it's going to be good for your farm business as well.
Well, I hope it's going to be good for our farm business. I still believe that there's an awful lot that Natural England and the Rural Payments Agency need to sort out. But if I look at the biodiversity element, absolutely essential we work together. My father originally started working with our neighbours over 30 years ago with the Bitten Reinstatement Project, where we started to grow 9 acres of reeds together. And that was basically the limit of it. Unfortunately, when we start looking into high-level stewardship, I'm on one scheme, my neighbour's on a different scheme, the neighbours on the other side of the river is on a different scheme, all with different start dates and slightly different land management requirements. And so the hope is that we can all be drawn in together and collectively make something which is really, really special and delivers for both the business and the wildlife.
Norfolk grazier Michael Smith. Professor Paul Dolman is part of the team at the University of East Anglia, which is encouraging the collaboration between farmers, landowners, conservationists and environmentalists.
We're really lucky in this country. There's this wealth of information and knowledge about all of our wildlife. So what we did was bring together all of this information from natural historians and people who've been recording various species. And we brought together all the data to understand for the first time how many species there are on the North Norfolk coast. And then our second crucial question was to ask, what do they need? Which are the really important ones, the rare, declining, threatened species that we really need to look after? And what do they need? What levels of grazing intensity, what ditch management, what water level management do these species need so that they can recover and flourish?
Much of this land is managed by large estates and smaller farmers. What kind of role do they have in supporting this biodiversity and these wildlife species?
All of these habitats, well, the freshwater marshes are created by farming. They were originally salt marsh. They were enclosed and drained, and they're grazed for livestock. So the role of the farmers is absolutely crucial in creating and maintaining these habitats. And the study was actually co-funded by the farmers themselves. We had at least 13 farmers put their hand in their pocket and help fund this big collaborative study. So we had Natural England, we had the local authorities, but we also had the farmers themselves, because they wanted the results. They wanted to see what the evidence is to link the wildlife that they have to the management and the prescriptions that could potentially be supported under ELBS.
That's Paul Dolman from the University of East Anglia.
So this sounds like a good initiative, Johan. As with all these sort of landscape group things, I suppose you get a big surface area, so therefore potentially you can have a really big impact.
Yeah, it's about working together, isn't it? Farmers working together and having a bigger impact than they would do working alone, a little bit like the buying group, to be honest, that we heard about earlier. But as you heard from the audio, this is not just big landowners doing this. This is, smaller landowners and smaller farmers, tenant farmers, getting involved too, and doing some simple things that can really make a big difference. So it was a good story to cover.
Absolutely, and the very best of luck to them with their efforts going forward. Moving on, Johan, next week's Farmers Weekly podcast, what are we featuring?
Next week, Hugh, you remember last week we had Rishi Sunak on the podcast talking about what he would do if he becomes the next Prime Minister. Next week, we're hoping to have Liz Truss on, and she'll be explaining what she'll do for farmers if she gets the keys to number 10.
Great stuff. Don't forget, if you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can. It is podcast@fwi.co.uk. That's podcast@fwi.co.uk. As ever, it would be great to hear from you. But in the meantime, this has been yet another episode of the Farmers Weekly Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Hugh Broome. Until next week, goodbye.
I'm Johan Tasker. Goodbye.